Turning today to the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 27, the book of Acts, chapter 27, and the first verse, and when it was determined that we should sail into Italy, they delivered Paul and certain other prisoners unto one named Julius, a centurion of Augustus' band. And our subject is Paul's great triumph in shipwreck, and it is an extraordinary narrative and a famous narrative. There is nothing quite like it in ancient literature, this narrative of Luke, the beloved physician of the shipwreck of Paul. I say the shipwreck of Paul. This was the fourth shipwreck of Paul. He already has told us in his Corinthian letters that he was shipwrecked three times, and they were written before this took place, towards the end of his ministry, the end of his third missionary journey, and now he goes as a prisoner, having appealed to Caesar. And right from the very beginning, well, what I propose to do today is to pass through this chapter, if it's possible, in a simple manner, and to follow the narrative, but just to point out some of the spiritual lessons that we can see on the way through. And here in the very first verse, when it was determined that we should sail into Italy, Luke never wastes words. He writes under the inspiration of the Spirit, but everything has significance, relevance. When it was determined, matters were, of course, out of the apostles' hands. He did not determine when he went to Italy, to Rome. He was a prisoner. Obviously, the Lord determined these things, but humanly speaking, everything that was happening to him was out of his hands. And so Luke expresses this right at the beginning of the narrative, when it was determined that we should sail into Italy, they delivered Paul. Well, Paul was a special prisoner. He was a Roman citizen. It is likely, of course we can't be certain, but it's likely that all the other prisoners were not Roman citizens. It's generally thought that they were condemned men, that they would have been tried in the lands where their crimes were committed, whatever they may have been, under Roman law. And they were now being taken to Rome for execution. That's very likely true. That's the best judgment of so many commentators. And they would have required considerable force to guard them. If there were 276 people on board that ship, and you know, incidentally, records show that some of these grain vessels that carried passengers that they were ultimately on, not at first, they were on a little coaster at first, but the main vessel that was shipwrecked could have 500 to 600 passengers. They were very large. We don't think of that in these modern times. We talk down everything that happens in the past or think down, but it was a large vessel. Sea-going vessel that they were ultimately on. And 276, many of them were prisoners. I don't suppose ordinary passengers cared to get on the prisoner vessels, the vessels that had been taken by Roman officers to transport those who were going to their death. There could be trouble, there could be attempts to break out, all kinds of mutinies might occur. So there were a considerable number of soldiers too, under a centurion named Julius. Now he's named, and he's named and he's noted for his courtesy. He bears a noble name for a Roman centurion, and it's marked that he's a centurion of Augustus' cohort or band in our translation. That is to say that he belongs to that crack regiment that was formed and maintained actually to be the bodyguard to Caesar, but its officers often chose to be detached out. These prisoner duties, you might think, were not that desirable or prestigious, but it got the centurion to visit distant places. So apparently, the experts tell us they liked them and they volunteered for these duties. So here is a probably, in the time, noble-born, educated officer, Julius, in that crack regiment, and he's on escort duty with quite a band of soldiers, no idea how many, no idea how many prisoners, and the crew. So it was mainly a prisoner boat. Julius, we'll read about it in due time, he'd found this vessel ready to sail and relatively empty of passengers, so he took it. And I expect the civil passengers promptly got off. They didn't want to be on a prisoner vessel. Anyway, here they are in verse 2. They entered into a ship of Adramyttium, and that's a coaster. We launched, meaning to sail by the coasts of Asia. One Aristarchus, we know him. What Luke and Aristarchus were doing on board, it's difficult to say. They probably went as private passengers to accompany the Apostle Paul. And verse 3, the next day we touched at Zidon, and Julius courteously entreated Paul. Paul's behaviour has already appeared to Julius as being entirely trustworthy. And so he most courteously offers that he can go and see his friends. Who are they in Zidon? Well, there's evidently a church there. We don't read about it anywhere else, in Acts or in the epistles, but there's a church there. And so when they get to that little port, Paul goes off, and the members of that church would have been so delighted and so pleased to have Luke the physician and Aristarchus, but especially Paul the apostle, visit them. But it's an insight into Paul's courtesy and bearing. He's not a sullen prisoner or passenger. He's somebody who the educated Julius can take to and trust. And though he's in his care as a prisoner, he dismisses him to go and visit the church. So it's an insight into Paul's bearing, how he came across. And verse 4, when we had launched from thence, we sailed under Cyprus, on the leeward side of the wind, because the winds were contrary. And when we had sailed over the sea of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, city of Lycia. And there they changed ships. Verse 6, they found a ship of Alexandria, a grain ship. Rome was supplied mainly from Egyptian grain ships. And he put us therein. And then, you see, things start to go wrong from verse 7. And when we had sailed slowly many days, there was no wind. There was a calm. It was too slow. They were at the end of the sailing season. Life would be getting dangerous. The gales and the tempests began soon in the region. And scarce were come over against Cnidus, the wind not suffering us. We sailed under Crete, over against Salmone, and hardly passing it, came unto a place which is called the Fair Havens. It's not known today, you can only guess what the name represents. Nigh whereunto was the city of Lycia. Now when much time was spent, since they left the port of Caesarea, probably, that's counting from there, and when sailing was now dangerous, because the fast was now already past, that's just a Jewish way of estimating the time of the year, so it's very late in the year, Paul admonished them. So you've come to this verse, the vessel is going too slowly. From, so the experts tell us, September to mid-November, you couldn't sail. The tumultuous winds came in, and it was dangerous, and you couldn't sail from that time until March. So Paul admonishes them. Who's he admonishing? Well, they're on the near the city of Lycia, they're on land, and the time is going by, and the Apostle Paul is quite experienced. He's been shipwrecked already in these regions three times in his life. And verse 10, he says unto them, sirs, politely, He's talking to the owner of the vessel and the pilot of the vessel and the centurion, the officer in charge, whether Luke's with him in this, but there's a little gathering. And he says just to them, I perceive that this voyage will be with hurt and much damage, not only of the lading and ship, but also of our lives. He's going to have a revelation from God in the course of this voyage that all lives would be saved. But he hasn't had it yet. And in his judgment, they're leaving it much too late to sail. Now, Paul is a man capable of great boldness, but he gives this warning. Verse 11, nevertheless, the centurion believed the master, that is the pilot or the helmsman, and the owner of the ship more than those things which were spoken by Paul. So Paul is kind of rebuffed, but he can absorb that. You see the conduct of the apostle. He gives due warning, he's fairly certain they're going to head right into trouble now. It's too late in the season for sailing. But they reject his view, and he doesn't go and sulk. He isn't somebody who says, well, it's up to you now, it's nothing to do with me. You'll see in the record, he continues to be, or becomes, in the course of events, the principal person, the main person on board. So he can absorb these kind of knocks and being set aside and his judgment thought nothing of. It's just a little insight there into the apostle and his character and his noble nature. Verse 12, because the haven was not commodious to winter in, the more part advised to depart thence also. Probably added others to the council group. If by any means they might attain to Phoenicia, a little place called Phoenix, and there to winter, which is an haven of Crete. And Luke tells us where it is. He always gives us the location, the details. And verse 13, when the south wind blew softly, supposing they had obtained their purpose, it's still gentle. The fierce winds are not starting yet. Loosing thence, they sailed close by Crete, and then the trouble really starts in verse 14. But not long after, there arose against it a tempestuous, a cyclonic wind, which swept down from the Cretan mountain called Euroclydon, Euroquillo in some versions, that's the Latin version. In some of the modern translations, they just call it a northeaster, which is what Euroclydon from the Greek means. A great cyclonic northeaster came sweeping down upon them. And verse 15, when the ship was caught, it was so ferocious, they could not bear up into the wind. We let her drive the minimum amount of sail, and just driven before the wind, scudding along at great speed. Verse 16, and running under a certain island, which is called Clauda, we had much work to come by the boat, probably rather large and heavy. Don't imagine just a little dinghy, but quite a vessel that would be trailed behind, and it was no doubt causing damage. It had to be brought half on board in order to make for safety. Verse 17, which when they had taken up, this is extraordinary, friends, they used helps, undergirding the ship, what is called by the mariners, frapping the ship. And the Greek indicates quite clearly what it is, that they had to run cables under the ship to tie it up all the way round in order to concentrate the pressure on the timbers and stop it falling apart. And that's a massive undertaking. Used to be done, we're told, in the ancient world, a great deal. Some people say they achieved it by, I don't know that we've time for these details, but by putting the cable, the rope, over the bow of the ship, where you can then somehow, with people pulling on each side, working it down the hull. so that the rope ended up amidships, right under. Some people say, no, you couldn't do that very successfully. They had to have somebody prepared to stake his life to go over the side and clamber down the rope work down the side of the vessel and go and attempt to get right underneath and up the other side to thread each rope. Sounds extraordinary in a tumultuous gale, but it was done. Otherwise, it was feared the ship's timbers would begin to explode outwards under pressure. And this is being done. This is called one of the greatest historic accounts of trapping a ship in all ancient literature. It's verse 17. They used helps or ropes or cables undergirding the ship. That's the predicament they were in. And fearing lest they should fall into quicksands, strake sail, which probably means that they took the mainsail down. Some people think it means they threw sea anchors out. The Greek could be translated either way. But the word strake is not meant in a more modern sense, but probably that they took the mainsail down and so were driven with just the minimum of rigging. And verse 18, we being exceedingly tossed with a tempest, the next day they lightened the ship. They got rid of as much tackle and any freight that was on deck. And verse 19, the third day, you notice the we now. We cast out with our own hands the tackling of the ship. The only explanation for this, it's been suggested, is that things were so dangerous, they had to get rid of the main yardarm, which means she'd never properly sail after this. And that was so heavy, so immense with all its tackle, that it took the trustable passengers too. So even Luke is involved and others. Everybody's there, as well as the crew, to somehow, in the ferocious storm, bundle out of the ship the main horizontal timber on the rigging. And verse 20, when neither sun nor stars in many days appeared, everything is black, and no small tempest, Luke often says this, no small, it means the opposite, of course, a tremendous tempest, a cyclone, lay on us. All hope that we should be saved was then taken away. It's emphatic. They completely lost hope that the ship could survive, that there could be any land or any rescue. Verse 21, but after long abstinence, it doesn't mean, I'm sure, that they ate nothing at all. It doesn't mean that there was some kind of ceremonial fast. You wouldn't think of that when you were being shipwrecked. Anyway, most of the people were pagan prisoners and the Roman crew, possibly. It means that because of the fury of the storm, nobody was thinking about food. Perhaps just took something as they could. But after long, no proper meals, obviously, Paul stood forth in the midst of them and said, now this sounds bad. This sounds as though Paul is sulking. I told you so, you should have listened to me. Who would trouble with this in the middle of a storm? Sirs, ye should have hearkened unto me, and not have loosed from Crete, and to have gained this harm and loss. But of course he's saying it for a purpose. He's saying it because he's reminding them that he advised against all this, and now he's got something important to say. They're going to listen to him. He knew. And this is what he says, verse 22. And now I exhort you to be of good cheer. In our translation, it sounds so elegant. You cannot somehow imagine somebody standing on a heaving deck in the middle of this furious tempest, with death staring them in the face, using this beautifully polite language, be of good cheer. So perhaps it's not the exact words that he said at all, but he shouted above the gale for them to cheer up in some shape or form, for there shall be no loss of any man's life among you, but of the ship. And here's the Apostle Paul He's going not ashamed to declare to them what God has said. He doesn't keep it to himself. In the middle of this great crisis, he's going to announce it to all. Even if they scorn him, he's going to give testimony. He's going to witness. For there stood by me this night the angel of God, whose I am and whom I serve, saying, they're beautiful words. The angel of God. It doesn't appear to be an appearance of Christ in this case, as it has been to him previously, though some think it was. It's definitely described as an angel of God. Whose I am, he's a servant of God. I am a servant of God, he tells the seamen and the prisoners above the gale. And whom I serve, and this was the message, verse 24, fear not, Paul. Thou must be brought before Caesar, and lo, God hath given thee all them that sail with thee. These are such important words, friends. God hath given thee. That's so significant. Not God will preserve the lives of all on board, that's true, but God hath given thee. It seems absolutely clear from that Paul had been praying for these people. They were pagan prisoners, sentenced to death in all probability, going to Rome to be put before the lions or involved as puppets in the gladiatorial contests, to be a show of death for Roman civilians. They were going to execution. And Paul evidently had been praying for them. Do you pray in the midst of every crisis? Something's happening, other people are there. He's with many other people, mostly prisoners and soldiers, many of them, most of them possibly very coarse people. And he prays for them. I dare to say he prays for their souls as well as for their lives, because the response of God through the angel is, God hath given thee. That's an answer to prayer language. And it has even more in it than that, because here's Paul. He's a messenger of Christ, he's an apostle, of course, but he's telling them, I believe in God. God whom I serve has stood by me. He's representing the Lord. He is a kind of priest on board that vessel. Of course, we're all priests. We're a priesthood of believers. But where the Apostle Paul was, and no doubt Luke took the same view, and maybe Aristarchus, the other Christian there, but wherever he was, even on a prison ship, he would say to himself, I am God's priest in this place. That's what we should all say. I am God's priest in this department of the office. I am God's priest in this lecture hall, among these students, in my room. I am God's representative. I pray for all these folk as though they're my responsibility to the Lord, and I witness to them as I'm given opportunity in wisdom and carefully, while I'm here, while I'm among these people. That's how Paul seems to see life, because he prays for them and he speaks to them. And God says, I have given you all these souls. I don't know how extensively we can apply this, whether it is that God is going to give the many of them to salvation. There isn't much time to preach the gospel in the middle of this terrifying gale that's bringing about the breakup of the ship, and there's certain deaths, so it would seem, but there will be when they're all landed safe ashore. Paul will speak to them on Cyprus. They'll see more of his character and of his message. How many of them will be saved? Does this reply include this? Lo, God hath given thee all them that sail with thee. Certainly their lives are going to be preserved. How many of their souls? Maybe Julius, the centurion, He's trusted Paul to go and see the church on a stopover, and now he sees his conduct, and he's the principal person becoming so on board this stricken vessel. Fear not, Paul, thou must be brought before Caesar. Paul knew that already. He was calm. And lo, God hath given thee all them that sail with thee. So he repeats his exhortation, verse 25. Wherefore, sirs, be of good cheer, for I believe God. That's what we say. Whenever the opportunity arises, wherever God has placed us, I believe in God. I believe him and his word. I believe God that it shall be even as it was told me. Howbeit, we must be cast upon a certain island. The angel didn't communicate any more than that to Paul, not where, not what it was called. But you can see there Paul's testimony and Paul's attitude and his sense of responsibility for all who were within earshot of him, all who were in any place with him. Verse 27, but when the 14th night was come, as we were driven up and down in Adria, that's not quite the Adriatic Sea, but the region a little more south, about midnight, the shipmen deemed that they drew near to some country. How? Well, they could hear breakers, I imagine, even above the ferocity of the storm. They could hear what to them, it's only the seamen that noticed this, their ears attuned to such sounds. The passengers and the soldiers and the escort probably wouldn't have noticed the, amidst the din, the distinctive sound of breakers landing on shore, but they seemed to know. And they sounded, they dropped the lead on a line into the water, and found it 20 fathoms, and then a little further, verse 28, 15 fathoms. But then they were filled with alarm, because as they drew near to the shore, they knew the region, they knew the area, they expected some reef, and indeed there was a little further along, that the ship would founder on. Fearing lest we should have fallen upon rocks, they cast four anchors out of the stern. What kind of anchors is debated by the experts, whether they were sea anchors to slow the vessel down, or whether they were metal anchors to make contact with the shallow now seabed and to stop the motion of the vessel, one or the other. Verse 30, and as the shipmen were about to flee out of the ship, there's another debate here, the crew were about to abandon ship. Some people think that included the owner and the helmsman, or the pilot, called the master, further on. Some people say, no, it wouldn't have included them. But it's interesting that it's only the soldiers and the centurion who can be turned to stop this. So very likely it's all the shipmen, including the owner and the helmsman. As the shipmen were about to flee out of the ship, they let down the boat into the sea again to make their escape, pretending that they were going to somehow get it round to the front of the vessel to get anchors out of the front. But Paul was vigilant. So the Apostle Paul, you just get a little insight into him. He knows that that vessel must reach shore intact, with all the crew on board, and all lives are going to be saved. He's a man of God. He's testifying, he's praying, but he's also watchful and vigilant and contributes whatever he can to the success and a successful outcome. Verse 31, Paul said to the centurion and to the soldiers, except these, the crew, abide in the ship, ye cannot be saved. And the soldiers promptly cut the ropes of the boat and let her fall off before the crew could get into it. And then Paul, verse 33, beseeches them to eat. You must eat. This is the 14th day, and they've given up. And he pleads with them. He's the chief person, really, on board, taking these key initiatives. And then he assures them at the end of verse 34, "For there shall not an hair fall from the head of any of you." And look what he does, verse 35. When he had thus spoken, he took bread and he said grace. He gave thanks to God in the presence of them all, the vessel being hurled about and the ferocious wind, and with a loud, clear voice, he gives thanks for the food and sets the example and eats. He's acting as a priest, as it were. That's how we should act on board. He's the one who's concerned about the others. He doesn't say, well, they've got to die anyway. They're going to execution. Why should I be worried about them? He prays for them. He prays, no doubt, for their souls. He feels for them. He exhorts them to eat something. He repeats his comfort to them that all are going to be saved. He's the major person on this vessel. Verse 36, and he's effective. Then were they all of good cheer, and they also took some meat. His confidence and his calm and his certainty was infectious, and they all took hope. And then the number in the vessel is given, verse 37. I suppose in a modern narrative we'd state that at the very top. But Luke defers the detail to 276 souls, well down the narrative. And they were eating fully. Verse 38, when they had eaten enough, they threw out all the grain into the sea. It was a grain ship. And when it was day, they knew not the land, the coastline. They discovered a certain creek with a shore, into the which they were minded, if it were possible, to thrust in the ship. It was very unlikely. When they had taken up the anchors that slowed the ship at the back, they committed themselves unto the sea. It ultimately was out of their control. They loosed the rudder bands, which probably means that they had fastened. You know, you didn't have a hinged rudder at the back of a vessel in those days. You had two long oar-like blades that ran from the rear, the stern, the side of the vessel. And if the sea was furious, you could tie them up alongside the vessel. And they were controlled by sort of bars that stuck out from the helm. But they loosed the rudder bands so that they're going to stabilize the ship as much as possible and hoist up the mainsail. The Greek indicates more the foresail. That was left, just a bit of foresail, to the wind, and made toward the shore. And falling into a place where two seas met, they ran the ship aground. The forepart stuck on the rocks, and the hinder part was promptly smashed up from the violence of the waves. And here, just before we get to the end, the soldiers knew their orders. They'd been on escort duty before. It was drilled into them. If anything happens, kill the prisoners. And they don't wait for the centurion's order. They all say among themselves, the time's come, kill them. Because in those days, the Roman rule was, it was a life for a life. If you were on escort duty and you lost a prisoner, you forfeited your life. So immediately they wanted to destroy the prisoners, lest any of them should swim out and escape. But the centurion, verse 43, Julius, you almost wonder if he's drawing close to the Lord. He's so influenced by Paul, he's so amazed at this man and his calm. Willing to save Paul. Yes, he was a Roman citizen, appealing to Caesar, but why should he be so willing to save Paul unless his own heart was gripped by this man? the centurion, willing to save Paul, kept them from their purpose, shouted out to them that all who could swim should go first into the sea, and the rest would take up the debris and the broken pieces, and there on those escape to land. And they did, all of them. Dear friends, what's this passage about? Well, it tells us that as Christian people, we should know trials. The apostle and Luke and Aristarchus, a terrible ordeal, and the fourth time it had happened to the apostle Paul. It tells us that Christians will know trials. We have to be proved, and we have to prove the Lord. And those trials may be very harsh and very threatening. And we keep our faith. And even if death should stare us in the face, we know that even death is a friend to the believer, and it takes us promptly into eternal glory. And we may often be in circumstances that are dictated by others, and there's nothing we can do to help ourselves. And this is God's will, because he's appointed us to be a demonstration of our faith and our calm and our help from God in the worst of circumstances. That's how the gospel is proved to other people, by their observation of believers, of us. And it's our task always to be lifting people up and bringing cheer and hope, and being ready to say, I believe in God, even on a heaving deck, in a murderous gale, to pray, to exercise priesthood, as it were. There is a sense in which these people around me are my responsibility. I am not going to let the Lord down. I am not going to lose my temper. I am not going to say things I would regret to anybody. I'm going to maintain, by his help, if I can, Christian character and witness throughout everything, because I'm appointed to these people and I shall pray for them. And God may perhaps determine that he will give to me certain souls, people to be saved. Julius, I'm fascinated by Julius. Of course, this is pure pulpit speculation, but I do wonder if he were deeply affected by the Apostle Paul. You know, when they got ashore to Cyprus, I won't go into the next chapter yet, but when they got ashore, they would hear Paul witness of Christ and speak to them and urge them and plead with their souls. As I mentioned before, how many of them came to Christ? How many of them who would be executed in due course for their crimes, like the dying thief who was saved, went straight to paradise when that happened, because they'd heard the Apostle Paul? Was Julius one of those people? Don't forget that Britain, a large part of Britain, had been conquered and ruled by the Romans since AD 43, a date that sticks in your mind from school days. Well, this is AD 60. Was this centurion one who would in due course go on some detachment to Britain? Was he one of the many soldiers and traders who took the gospel to Britain, to these shores, or to Spain, or to other places? Was he one of those who was given to the apostle in the most complete sense of that language? He would say throughout his life, I owe my life to the Apostle Paul. I was on a shipwrecked vessel. It was certain death for all of us. We've never known anything like it. But it was because Paul the Apostle was on that vessel, and he was designated to be preserved by the Lord for the sake of the gospel until his martyrdom. Because of that, we were all saved. And I saw that man, and I saw his deportment, and I saw his bearing, and I heard his words. And yes, he was the main man in that terrible and violent storm. And I listened to what he said, and I'll never forget him and his character and his message and what he brought me to understand. Well, that's speculation, but there's something in it that the angel of the Lord said, I've given you all the lives of those on board. Well, it's a challenge to us. If the Apostle Paul would go through this shipwreck with such triumph, surely we can gird ourselves up in our everyday lives to be a kingdom of priests representing the Lord, manifesting that right behavior, laying hold on divine power, telling people we believe, living as Christians ought to live. Of course, the apostle would be put through a trial like this. He is so important in the proclamation of the word and the forming of the early church. He had to be tried. It had to be demonstrated that he was truly the Lord's and that he was a man of prayer in all situations. And we see it here in the Word of God. That's why there's so much detail in the narrative. The Apostle Paul and his great triumph. Well, may ours reflect his day by day. Dear friends, let's close our thinking, singing the hymn 469. Hymn number 469.